The sacred land, it has seen many hands, it has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old, and now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So you know some people, they just won't understand, or just won't understand these things. Thank you for your message, but I don't understand.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gail Lippo, who's an activist and independent journalist whose published works include writings on political economy and climate change for the online magazine Grist. He's the author of the new book, Solving the Climate Crisis Through Social Change, Public Investment in Social Prosperity to Cool a Fevered Planet. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gail Lippo.
I'm glad to be here, Ian.
And today we're a couple of days ahead of Earth Day on Sunday. I'll be broadcasting live from the Los Angeles Times Book Fair at USC, but obviously Earth Day should not go unnoticed, and I'm glad that you can join us. Your book offers up a lot of solutions that citizens can do in terms of their own carbon footprint, but let's just begin with the political problem itself, and that is that as long as we have the corrupt political system we have in this country, where since Citizens United, there's just a flood of corporate money pouring in. The powerful corporations essentially own our politicians, and the most powerful among them are the oil companies. So as long as we have the political system we have, it seems to me very unlikely that there will be any political change to address the challenge of climate change.
Well, I think you're right, but I think it's a larger problem than you laid out. It's worth remembering that we've had our politicians mostly a wholly owned subsidiary of the corporate system long before Citizens United. That made it much worse. But the fact is, we've had a Supreme Court decision decades ago that said money is free speech, which itself, that's much older than Citizens United. And that causes a lot of problems. And then I think you'll find the politics ultimately comes problem is from the extreme inequality and atomization or fragmentation in our society. That is, it's hard to tackle either the climate crisis or any of the other problems while you've got such huge disparities in economic power. And the political power tends to... the political power tends to flow from that. That ultimately, I think you'll find the climate crisis, and that's one of the points of the book. The climate crisis stems from the same causes as a lot of our other crises. That is, you've got the unemployment, you have inequality between men and women, and they're all stemming from fragmentation and inequality. So, fundamentally, the idea of the book is that the political and economic point of the book, which is the main point of the book, is that the climate crisis, like many of our other problems, are actually toxic waste as a side effect of our political and economic system.
So are you suggesting then, Gail Lippo, that we have to change our political economic system first, or is that
the... Or at the same time. It's because here's the thing. How do you change a political... an economic system, you don't abstractly say, oh, let's get a new system. You fight concrete battles. And so it's not that you do it first, but that fighting to solve the climate crisis has to be seen as part of a larger fight. You fight to solve the climate crisis. You fight for other ecological issues. You fight for justice, economic justice. You know, you fight for single-payer health. You fight for women's rights. You fight for labor rights. That's extremely important. You do all these things. And yes, you fight to get the money out of politics. You do these 101 battles we have to do, but they need to be linked. They need to somehow get some sort of network or way that all these fights stop being so fragmented and tend to converge together. And that's why, for all its many flaws, why the Occupy movement is so important, because it's the first time we've seen something where you do have a lot of different groups coming together.
Again, I'm speaking with Gail Lippo, who's an activist and independent journalist whose published works include writing on political economy and climate change for the online magazine Grist. He's the author of the new book, Solving the Climate Crisis Through Social Change, Public Investment in Social Prosperity to Cool a Fevered Planet. And we're talking about this in advance of Earth Day on Sunday. Of course, you've got a chapter in your book, if you want to get to heaven, you got to raise a little hell. I guess that's what you're talking about. But this is a profound transition, though, isn't it, from the people have got to take back the power, their own power. They've got to find their own power, in effect. That's a summary of what you're saying, because the powerful, the wealthy, money seems to talk in this country, and the 1% have concentrated wealth, and they seem to be basically calling the tune at the moment. Do you think that the climate change issue will galvanize the powerless into action?
On its own, no. I don't think any environmental cause has ever been strong enough in the U.S. public mind to be a high enough priority to say, we're going to do all this to solve the climate crisis. But fortunately, you don't have to. For instance, one of the big points about in the book is that one of the major solutions is massive public investment. Because a lot of these things, no matter how much you get, you know, you make pollution more expensive, which a lot of mainstream environmentalists say is the big thing you have to do. Well, it's certainly one of the things you have to do to make pollution more expensive. But at the same time, there are a lot of causes out, problems out there that aren't going to be solved. You're not going to get trains by making pollution more expensive. And the truth is, because of the way people act, you're not going to get houses well insulated. Right now, if people acted just on the basis of things being expensive enough, most of our houses would be a heck of a lot better insulated. And so ultimately, you need large-scale public investment. You need public taxpayer money going into a lot of these things. Well, the good thing about that is that also provides a heck of a lot of jobs. It helps break our whole economic bottleneck. So one of the things we need to do to solve the climate crisis, massive public investment in green infrastructure, can also be supported as a way of helping the 99% economically. And in fact, a lot of unions and civil rights groups support just this. There's the Blue Green Alliance out there. The NAACP has a huge portion of their organization devoted to fighting climate change, and so on and so forth. So it's not like a lot of civil rights and labors and feminist groups don't already realize this and are already working on these things for that very reason. So that's what gives hope. And of course, public investment is just one of the things, but you'll find the same thing happens. Almost everything we have to do to solve the climate crisis also helps solve other crises. So if environmentalists would stop trying to say we are, you know, the key problem, we're the ones tackling the key problem, rally around us and start saying, hey, we're out here, we're supporting this in solidarity with you, and looking at themselves as one movement among many and pushing their agenda in a way that helps others solve their agenda, that is a huge opportunity.
Well, of course, that's been one of the problems with the political left in this country is the balkanization of identity politics, and that people can't get beyond their own identity and their own particular political, obsession. That, of course, requires a rethinking, reorientation of the very nature of political activism, and to actually practice what a lot of people on the left preach, which is solidarity. There isn't a lot of solidarity on the left. That's the whole problem.
You're absolutely right, and that's one of the things that this book pushes is the importance of solidarity. But it shows how solidarity would benefit everybody, that it's not just a nice political principle, that it's political survival.
So what about personal morality? I mean, I remember when Bush and Cheney got elected, Cheney made the remark about electric cars, that environmentalism is about personally feeling good, but it doesn't really amount to much. That is the most cynical attitude that's still fairly pervasive. But beyond recycling and stuff like that, I heard a very interesting suggestion from a climate scientist up in Washington State University, who has studied mass extinctions, and most of them, I think four out of five have been the result of climate change. He said that one simple thing that people can do throughout the entire planet will be to paint their roofs white. Have you heard that suggestion?
I have. I mean, it's a way of, mitigation. Especially, would be even better if it was paint the roofs white and paint roads and to paint roads and pavements white as well, parking lots. Mm-hmm. That could be a huge short-term reduction in warming. It doesn't reduce emissions, but it kind of helps counteract some of them, gives us time. You know, is other things you can do is, you know, we had a thing where I think we insulated about a few million homes with public investments. I think every home that's under insulated could be insulated with public funds. That would be a really tremendous employment thing. And the book also outlines how you could actually replace our electric grid with mostly solar and wind over the course of 20 years, and how you, just in an appendix, and also how you can then take that, how you can use energy more efficiently, not in, only in homes, but in transportation and in industry, and how you could gradually use this renewable electricity to replace most of the energy consumption in those sectors as well. And so that's the important thing. And yes, in the meantime, absolutely, anything like this, because the one thing about these white roofs and white pavements and things is it's cheap enough that that a city that's progressive or a state that's progressive could probably fund that. And although it's a little more expensive, you know, cities and states are doing a lot on insulation. Again, not on the scale that needs to be done. No city can afford to insulate every home in the city. That ultimately would take federal funds. But a lot of cities and counties and states fund insulation, at least for poor people and for elderly people, and that's a good start.
So just in closing, Gaylippo, the book talks about the 17th century forests of New England, the evolution of housework over 200 years, the American addiction to the automobile, the lettuce fields of California in the 1970s, the guano wars of the 19th century in Bolivia, Chile, and Peru. Just give us a sense of how those disparate incidents, historical incidents, tie together into your thesis.
To give you one or two examples, the thing about housework, for instance, in housework, one example is that over the course of housework, you gradually got, over the 17th and 18th century, technology eliminated a lot of housework, but a lot of it was housework that had been done by men and by children. And women's workload did not drop much. And then once you got to the early 20th century and you started getting automobiles, one of the things that happened was that stores moved from delivery. It had been pretty common for stores to deliver groceries. You would go to, if you were going to a store as opposed to buying from a door to a peddler, you would go to that store, you would select your stuff, and then you would go home and they would deliver it. Or in some cases, you would even phone the store and ask them to deliver things. And what they started saying is, we can provide the groceries a lot cheaper if we have self-service. But the reason it was cheaper is that you had the women going to the store in the automobiles and pick it up. And because women's time was counted as nothing, that grocery delivery was counted as a complete saving, no net cost. And so one of the things that happened is before the elimination of delivery, even though you had suburbs going, they were what was called streetcar suburbs, where they were at, where the suburbs were a lot like small towns. And so people would take a train into the city, and you would have the suburb where you still weren't automobile dependent. You still could have get along around with delivery and bicycles and walking. And once you had people driving to the stores, all of a sudden the suburbs didn't have to be built that way, and you got the modern suburb where you have to drive everywhere. And that contributed as much as commuting to our automobile dependence. You know, everyone thinks about, well, people take their cars and drive to work, but that's actually only a tiny percent of automobile emissions. If you look at it, shopping and school and church and recreation account for a lot more automobile emissions than personal transportation to work. And it's and the evolution, the gendered nature of housework, and not counting housework and shopping and things as in any way a cost, helped contribute to that. Now, I don't know how much time you have, but there
well,
are...
Well, yeah, I think we pretty much don't have a lot of time to go through the rest of them.
Those other stories are the same thing, where emissions arose as a side effect of other things. You know, what you're seeing when I talk about housework, that's you see that the main point about that is the injustice to women. It's not the emissions aren't the main story there, but the emissions there are a side effect. And the same thing happened in all these other things. Pollution is a toxic side effect of the way inequality and markets tend to work.
Well, clearly there's an awful lot to be learned from your book, and I thank you for joining us here today, Gail Lippow.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Gail Lippow, as an activist and independent journalist whose published works include writing on political economy and climate change for the online magazine Grist. He's the author of the new book, Solving the Climate Crisis Through Social Change, Public Investment in Social Prosperity to Cool a Fevered Planet. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday, Earth Day, from the LA Times Book Fair at USC. Bye for now.